In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Chapter 5 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 5. His Grace of Andover. Lady Lavinia dressed herself with even more than her usual care next afternoon, and well-nigh drove her maid distracted by her flashes of temper and impatient, contradictory orders. So lengthy was the toilette that she was only just in her boudoir when His Grace of Andover was announced. She had no time to tell the footman that she would receive His Grace, for almost before the words were out of James's mouth he stood bowing in the doorway, sure of his welcome. He was curiously like his sister, this man, and at the same time curiously unlike. Hers were the high cheekbones and pinched aristocratic nostrils, but the mouth with its thin lips and the heavy-lidded green eyes were totally different. His Grace's brows slanted up at the corners, and his eyes, though piercing and bright, were constantly veiled by the black-lashed lids. He wore his own black hair, unpowdered, and that, together with the black and silver garments that he always affected, greatly enhanced the natural pallor of his countenance. Altogether it was a very striking figure that stood just before the closed white door and bowed to Milady. Lavinia took an eager step towards him, swinging her pearl-gray brocades.
"Oh, Tracy!"
she cooed, holding out both hands. His Grace advanced into the room and bent low over them. "I rejoice to find you within, Lavinia," he said, a faint tinge of sarcasm running through his smooth tones. "As you perceive, I rode over." He made a gesture towards his high boots with their wicked-looking spurs. "No doubt Andrew forgot to give you my letter?"
"No,"
she said, slipping her hand in his arm.
He remembered in time, and oh, Tracy, I was so vastly delighted to have it.
"I am indeed honoured," he replied. "I am come on a sufficiently important matter."
"Oh?"
She pulled her hand away disappointedly.
"Money?"
"You are really wonderful, my dear, as you so crudely remark, money. Will you not be seated?" She sank down on the couch dejectedly, and watched him take a chair opposite her. "Your most noble lord and master lent me a trifling sum the other day, but very trifling. I am, as usual, hard-pressed, and that young fool Andrew must needs fall into debt."
Milady opened wide her eyes in surprise.
"Do you tell me you need money from Richard to pay Andrew's debts?"
she asked frankly, incredulous.
"I do not. Is it likely?" "The remark was purely by the way."
"Well, in any case, Andrew borrowed 3,000 from poor Dick only yesterday. I know, because I heard him speak of it."
His Grace raised his black brows in patient exasperation.
"How unnecessary of Andrew, and how typical. So poor Dick has been squeezed already?"
"Don't speak like that, Tracy," she cried. "Dickie is good to me."
She met his piercing look unflinchingly.
"Now this becomes interesting," drawled the Duke. "Since when have you come to that conclusion? And why this sudden loyalty?"
"I have always been loyal to him, Tracy. You know I have. I worry him, and indeed he is very forbearing."
"But how charming of him!"
"No, do not sneer, Tracy. He has promised to take me to London for the whole winter."
His Grace leant back in his chair again.
"Now I understand," he said placidly. "I was at a loss before."
"'Tis not that, Tracy. Indeed, I realize how kind he is to me. And we have quarrelled again. We are always quarrelling, and I know 'tis all my fault."
"What a comfortable conviction, my dear."
"No, no, 'tis not comfortable, Tracy. for somehow I cannot change my disposition, though I mean to be patient and sweet. Tracy, I hate Wyncham."
"You hate Wyncham? There was a time."
I know. But I never meant to live here always like this. I want to go to London."
"I thought you said you were going."
"Yes, I am. But I want to go with someone who is gay, not...
"In fact, you want distraction, and not with the amiable Richard. Well, I can conceive that life with him might prove uninspiring. Safe, my dear, but not exciting."
"I knew you would understand. You see, he does not like me to play at cards, because I cannot stop, and he cannot see how 'tis that I care not for what he calls home life, when there are routs in the play and real life. He is so staid, Tracy, and careful."
"A good trait in a husband, Lavinia," replied his Grace cynically. "'Tis because I do not possess it that I am single now." His lips curled scornfully at this, for well she knew her brother.
"No, Tracy, that is not so. It is because you are the devil. No woman would marry you."
"That is most interesting, my dear," purred his Grace. "But pray, strive to be a little more original. Continue your analysis of Richard's sterling character."
"'Tis only that we are so different," she sighed. "I always desire to do things quickly. If I think of something, I want it at once, you know, Tracy. And he likes to wait and think on it, and, oh, 'tis so tiresome, and it puts me in a bad humour, and I behave like a hysterical bourgeois."
She got up swiftly, clasping her nervous little hands.
"When he speaks to me in that gentle, reasoning way, I could scream, Tracy. Do you think I am mad?"
She laughed unmusically.
"No," he replied. "But the next thing to it, a Belmanoir. Perhaps it was a pity you ever married Richard. But there is always the money."
"There is not,"
she cried out sharply.
"Not? What mean you?"
"Tracy, 'tis of this that I wanted to speak. You think my lord left his money to Dick?"
"Certainly. He should be stupendously wealthy."
"He is not."
"But, my good girl, the revenue must be enormous. He has the land, surely."
No, he has not the land. Oh, but I am angry whenever I think on it. He induced my lord to leave it to John. He has but his younger son's portion."
"I still fail to understand. You inform me that the earl left all to Richard."
"He changed his will, Tracy."
"He changed his will? Then, my dear, you must have played your cards very badly."
"'Twas not my fault, Tracy, indeed 'twas not. I knew not until the will was read. Richard never spoke a word to me about it, and now we are comparatively poor."
Her voice trembled with indignation, but his Grace only whistled beneath his breath.
"I always knew, of course, that Dick was a fool. But I never guessed how much so till now."
At that she flared up.
"He is not a fool! He is an honest man, and his we, I tell you, who are mean and despicable and mercenary."
"Undoubtedly, Lavinia. But pray, do not excite yourself so over it. I suppose he is still devoted to that young hothead?"
Yes, 'tis all Jack, 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 until I am sick to death of the sound of his name. And—"
she broke off, biting her lip.
"And what?"
"Oh, not. But 'tis all so disagreeable, Tracy."
She stamped angrily.
"Oh, where's the good in being flippant?"
"My dear Lavinia, where's the good in being anything else? The situation strikes me as rather amusing. To think of the worthy Richard so neatly overturning all my plans."
"If it had not been for you, I might never have married him. Why did you throw them both in my way? Why did I ever set my eyes on either of them?"
"It should have been a good match, my dear. And if I remember rightly, no one was more alive to that fact than yourself."
She pouted angrily and turned her shoulder to him.
"Still," he continued reflectively, "I admit that for the smart lot we are, we do seem rather to have bungled the affair."
Lavinia swept round upon him.
"Oh, do you care no more than that? How can you be so casual? Does it affect you not at all?"
He wrinkled his thin nose expressively. "I shall not weep over it, Lavinia, but 'tis a plaguey nuisance. But we must see what can be done, and that brings me back to the original subject. Despite these upsetting revelations, I still require that money."
"Oh, dear. How much must you have, Tracy?"
500 might suffice."
"Tracy, do not the estates bring in anything?"
she asked petulantly.
"And Andrew told us you had a run of marvellous luck not a fortnight since."
"Since then, my dear, I have had 3 runs of marvellous ill luck. As to the estates, they are mortgaged up to the hilt, as you very well know. What little there is between 3, and Robert is extravagant."
"I hate Robert!"
"I am not partial to him myself, but it makes no odds."
"I wish he might die." "Oh, no, no. Now I am become ill-natured again. I don't wish it, only I am so tired of everything. You shall have that money as soon as possible, but be careful, Tracy, please be careful. 'Tis not easy to get money from Dick."
"No, I should imagine not. However, we have managed rather well up to the present. Take it all in all."
"Up to the present he has had all the money he wanted. My lord denied him not."
"Well, 'tis unfortunate, as I said before, but it must be endured. Where is Dick?"
"I know not. You will stay to dinner, Tracy."
"Thank you. I shall be charmed."
"Yes, yes, oh, how prodigiously pleasant it is to see you again. Soon I shall come to Andover. Will you let me stay a few days?"
"The question is, will Richard allow you to stay so long in my contaminating presence?"
"Richard would never keep me away, Tracy," she replied proudly. "He could not. Oh, why is it that I don't love him more? Why do I not care for him as much as I care for you, even?"
"My dear Lavinia, like all Belmanoirs, you care first for yourself and secondly for the man who masters you. That, alas, Richard has not yet succeeded in doing."
"But I do love Richard. I do, yet—"
"Exactly. Yet. The grand passion has not yet touched you, my dear, and you are quite self-absorbed."
"Self-absorbed? Those are hard words."
"But not too hard for the case. You think solely of yourself, your own pleasure, your own character, your own feelings. If you could cast yourself into the background a little, you would be less excitable and considerably less discontented."
"How dare you, Tracy! Pray, what of you? Are you so selfless?"
"Not at all. I am precisely the same. I was merely suggesting that you might be happier, and you could depose self."
"You had best do the same yourself."
"My dear Lavinia, when I feel the need of greater happiness, I most undoubtedly shall. At present I am quite content."
"You are unkind," she protested, "and you sneer at me."
"Pray accept my heartfelt apologies. You shall come to Andover if the worthy Richard permits." Her face cleared as by magic.
"Oh, Tracy! Oh, I'm so desirous to be gay once more. I cannot even receive now on account of this mourning. But when I am at Andover, oh, we will not worry over anything, and I can be bad-tempered without feeling that someone is being hurt by me. I'll come to Dickie at once, at once."
He rose leisurely. "I can imagine that you try Richard's patience somewhat," he remarked. "Happily, your impetuosity in no way disturbs me. We will go in search of Richard." Halfway down the great staircase, she perceived her husband and flew to meet him.
"Richard, I was coming in search of you. Tracy has invited me to Andover for a week. He purposes to ask several people to stay, and there will be parties and entertainment. You will let me go? Say yes, Dick. Say yes quickly."
Carstairs bowed to His Grace, who stood watching them from the stairs. The bow was returned with exaggerated flourish. Carstairs looked down at his wife.
"So soon, Lavinia," he remonstrated, in indicating her mourning.
She shook off his hand impatiently.
"Oh, Dickie, does it matter? What can it signify? I do not ask you to come."
"No," he said half sadly, half amusedly. "I notice that, my dear."
"No, no, I did not mean to be unkind. You must not think that. You don't think it, do you, Dick?"
"Oh, no," he sighed.
"Good, Dicky."
She patted his cheek coaxingly.
"Then you will allow me to go? Ah, but yes, yes, you must listen. You know how dull I am, and how silly. 'Tis because I need a change, and I want to go to Andover. I want to go."
"Yes, dear, I know. But my father is not yet dead 6 weeks, and I cannot think it seemly."
"Please, Dick, please! Please do not say no. 'Twill make me so unhappy. Oh, you will not be so unkind. You will not forbid me to go."
"I ask you not to, Lavinia. If you need a change, I will take you quietly to Bath, or where you will. Do not pain me by going to Andover just now."
"Bath? Bath? What do I want with Bath at this time of year? Oh, 'tis kind in you to offer, but I want to go to Andover. I want to see all the old friends again, and I want to get away from everything here. 'Tis all so gloomy after my lord's death."
"Dearest, of course you shall go away. But if only you would remember that you are in mourning."
"But 'tis what I wish to forget. Oh, Dickie, don't be unkind."
"Very well, dear. If you must go, go." She clapped her hands joyfully.
"Oh, thank you, Dickie. You are not angry with me?"
"No, dear. Of course not."
"Ah, now I am happy. 'Tis sweet of you, Dickie, but confess, you are secretly thankful to be rid of me for a week. Now, are you not?"
She spread out her fan in the highest good humour, and coquetted behind it. Richard was induced to smile. "I fear I shall miss you too sadly, dear."
"Oh," she dropped the fan, "but think how you will look forward to seeing me again, and I you. Why, I shall be so thankful to be back after a week away, that I shall be good for months."
His face lightened, and he caught her hands in his. "Darling, if I thought you would miss me—"
"But of course I shall miss you, Dick. Oh, pray, mind my frock. Shall I not miss him, Tracy?"
Richard suddenly remembered his brother-in-law's presence. He turned and went to the foot of the stairs. "So you are determined to wrest my wife from me?" he smiled. Tracy descended leisurely, opening his snuff-box. "Yes, I require a hostess," he said. "And I have," he paused, "induced her to honour Andover with her presence. Shall we have the felicity of seeing you at any time?" "I thank you, no. I am not, you will understand, in the mood for the gaiety for which my poor Lavinia craves." The Duke bowed slightly, and they all three went out onto the terrace, Lavinia laughing and talking as Richard had not heard her laugh or talk for days. She was the life and soul of the little dinner party, flirting prettily with her husband, and exerting herself to please him in every way. She had won her point. Therefore she was in excellent spirits with all the world, and not even the spilling of some wine on her new silk served to discompose her. End of Chapter 5. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona, July 2011. Chapter 6 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 6. Bath, 29 Queen Square. The autumn and the winter passed smoothly, and April found the Carstairs installed at Bath, whither Lady Lavinia had teased her husband into going, despite his desire to return to Wyncham and John. She herself did not care to be with the child, and was perfectly content that Richard should journey occasionally to Wyncham to see that all was well with him. On the whole, she had enjoyed the winter, for she had induced Richard to open Wyncham House, Mayfair, the Earl's town residence, where she had been able to hold several entirely successful routs, and many select little card parties. Admirers she had a many, and nothing so pleased her vain little heart as masculine adulation. Carstairs never entered his home without stumbling against some fresh flame of hers, but as they mostly consisted of what he rudely termed the lapdog type, He was conscious of no jealous qualms, and patiently submitted to their inundation of his house. He was satisfied that Lavinia was happy, and, as he assured himself at times, when he was most tried, nothing else signified. The only flaw to Lavinia's content was the need of money. Not that she was stinted, or ever refused anything that he could in reason give her, but her wants were never reasonable. She would demand a new town chariot, upholstered in pale blue, not because her own was worn out or shabby, but because she was tired of its crimson cushions, or she would suddenly take a fancy to some new and usually fabulously expensive toy, and having acquired it, weary of it in a week. Without a murmur, Richard gave her lap-dogs of the real kind, black pages, jewels, and innumerable kickshaws, for which she rewarded him with her brightest smiles and tenderest caresses. But when she required him to refurnish Wyncham House in the style of the French court, throwing away all the present Queen Anne furniture, the tapestries, and the countless old trappings that were one and all so beautiful and so valuable, he put his foot down with a firmness that surprised her. Not for any whim of hers was Jack's house to be spoiled. Neither her coaxing nor her tears had any effect upon Richard, and when she reverted to sulks, he scolded her so harshly that she was frightened, and, in consequence, silenced. For a week she thought and dreamt of nothing but gilded French chairs, and then abruptly, as all else, the fancy left her, and she forgot all about it. Her mantua-maker's bills were enormous, and caused Richard many a sleepless night, but she was always so charmingly penitent that he could not find it in his heart to be angry. And after all, he reflected, he would rather have his money squandered on her adornment than on that of her brothers. She was by turns passionate and cold to him, one day rapturing him by some pretty blandishment, the next snapping peevishly when he spoke to her. At the beginning of the season he dutifully conducted her to routs and balls masqués, but soon she began to go always with either Andrew or Robert, both of whom were in town, and whose casual chaperonage she much preferred to Richard's solicitous care. Tracy was rarely in London for more than a few days at a time, and the Carstairs, greatly to Richard's relief, saw but little of him. Carstairs disliked Colonel Lord Robert Belmanoir, but the Duke he detested, not only for his habitual sneer towards him, but for the influence that he undoubtedly held over Lavinia. Richard was intensely jealous of this, and could sometimes hardly bring himself to be civil when his Grace visited Milady. Whether justly or not, he inwardly blamed Tracy for all Lavinia's crazy whims and periodical fits of ill-temper. It did not take his astute Grace long to discover this, and with amused devilry he played upon it, encouraging Lavinia in her extravagance, and making a point of calling on her whenever he was in town. Carstairs never knew when not to expect to find him there. He came and went to and from London with no warning whatsoever. No one ever knew where he was for more than a day at a time, and no one was in the least surprised if he happened to be seen in London when he should, according to all accounts, have been in Paris. They merely shrugged their shoulders and exchanged glances, murmuring, "Devil Belmanoir!" and wondering what fresh intrigue he was in. So altogether Richard was not sorry when Milady grew suddenly sick of town and was seized with a longing for Bath. He had secretly hoped that she might return to Wyncham, but when she expressed no such wish, he stifled his own longing for home, shut up the London house, and took her and all her baggage to Bath, installing her in Queen Square, in one of the most elegantly furnished houses in the place. Lady Lavinia was at first charmed to be there again, delighted with the house and transported over the excellencies of the new French milliner she had discovered. But the milliner's bills proved monstrous, and the drawing-room of her house not large enough for the routs she contemplated giving. The air was too relaxing for her, and she was subject to constant attacks of the vapours that were as distressing to her household as they were to herself. The late hours made her head ache as it never ached in London, and the damp gave her a cold. Furthermore, the advent of an attractive and exceedingly wealthy little widow caused her many a bitter hour, to the considerable detriment of her good temper. She was lying on a couch in her white and gilt drawing-room one afternoon. Alas!
The craze for French furniture was o'er, smelling bottle in hand, and a bona fide ache in her head, when the door opened and Tracy walked into the room.
"Good heavens!"
she said faintly, and uncorked her salts. It was his Grace's first appearance since she had come to Bath, and the fact that he had politely declined an invitation that she had sent to him still rankled in her mind. He bowed over the limp hand that she extended, and looked her up and down.
"I regret to find you thus indisposed, my dear sister," he said smoothly.
"'Tis not. Only one of my stupid headaches. I am never well here, and this house is stuffy,"
she answered fretfully.
"You should take to the waters," he said, scrutinizing through his eyeglass the chair to which she had waved him. "It has an unstable appearance, my dear. I believe I prefer the couch."
He moved to a small sofa and sat down.
"Pray, how long have you been in Bath?"
she demanded.
"I arrived last Tuesday week."
Lady Lavinia started up.
"Last Tuesday week? Then you have been here 10 days and not visited me until now."
He appeared to be examining the whiteness of his hands through the folds of black lace that drooped over them.
"I believe I had other things to do," he said coolly.
A book of sermons that she had been trying to peruse slid to the ground as Lavinia jerked a cushion into place.
"And you come to me when it suits you. How could you be so unkind as to refuse my invitation?"
There was a rising, querulous note in her voice which gave warning of anger.
"My dear Lavinia, if you exhibit your deplorable temper to me, I shall leave you, so have a care. I thought you would understand that your good husband's society, improving though it may be, would be altogether too oppressive for my taste. In fact, I was surprised at your letter."
"You might have come for my sake,"
she answered peevishly, sinking back again.
"I suppose you have been dancing attendance on the Molesley women. Lord, but I think you men have gone crazy."
Understanding came to his Grace, and he smiled provokingly.
"Is that what upsets you? I wondered."
"No, 'tis not," she flashed. "And I do not see why you should think so. For my part, I cannot see that she is even tolerable, and the way the men rave about her is disgusting. Disgusting! But 'tis always the same when a woman is unattached and wealthy. Well, well, why do you not say something? Do you find her so lovely?"
"To tell you the truth, my dear, I have barely set eyes on the lady. I have been otherwise engaged, and I have done with all women for the time, save one."
"So, I have heard you say before. Do you contemplate marriage?" "Lord, but I pity the girl."
She gave a jeering little laugh, but it was evident that she was interested. His Grace was not in the least degree ruffled.
"I do not contemplate marriage, Lavinia, so your sympathies are wasted. I have meant a girl, a mere child, for sure, and I will not rest until I have her."
"Lord, another farmer's chit!"
"No, my dear sister, not another farmer's chit. A lady."
"God help her! Who is she? Where does she live?"
"She lives in Sussex. Her name I shall not tell you."
Her ladyship kicked an offending cushion onto the floor and snapped at him.
"Oh, as you please. I shall not die of curiosity."
"Ah!"
The cynical lips curled annoyingly, and Lady Lavinia was seized with a mad desire to hurl her smelling bottle at him. But she knew it that it was worse than useless to be angry with Tracy. So she yawned ostentatiously and hoped that she irritated him. If she did, she got no satisfaction from it, for he continued quite imperturbably.
"She is the daintiest piece ever a man saw, and I'll swear there's blood and fire beneath the ice."
"Is it possible the girl will have none of your grace?"
wondered Lavinia in mock amazement, and had the pleasure of seeing him frown. The thin brows met over his arched nose, and the eyes glinted a little, while she caught a glimpse of cruel white teeth closing on a sensual underlip. She watched his hand clench on his snuff-box,
and exulted silently at having roused him. It was a very brief joy, however, for the next moment the frown had disappeared, the hand unclenched, and he was smiling again. "At present she is cold," he admitted. "But I hope that in time she will become more plastic. I think, Lavinia, I have some experience with your charming, if capricious, sex."
"I don't doubt you have. Where did you meet this perverse beauty?"
"In the pump room."
"Lord, pray describe her."
"I shall be delighted. She is taller than yourself, and dark. Her hair is like a dusty cloud of black, and it ripples off her brow and over her little ears in a most damnably alluring fashion. Her eyes are brown, but there are lights in them that are purest amber, and yet they are dark and velvety." My lady had recourse to the smelling bottle. "But I perceive I weary you. A man in love, my dear Lavinia." She was up again at that.
"In love? You? Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. You do not know what the word means. You are like a fish, with no more of love in you than a fish, and no more heart than a fish, and—"
"Spare me the rest, I beg. I am very clammy, I make no doubt. But you will at least accord me more brain than a fish."
"Oh, you have brain enough," she raged. "Brain for evil, I grant you that."
"It is really very kind of you."
"The passion you feel now is not love. It is...
"Your pardon, my dear, but at the present moment I am singularly devoid of all strenuous emotions. So your remark is—"
"Oh, Tracy! Tracy, I am even quarrelling with you!" she cried wretchedly. "Oh, why? Why?"
"You are entirely mistaken, my dear. This is but the interchange of compliments. Pray, do not let me hinder you in the contribution of your share." Her lip trembled.
"Go on, Tracy, go on."
"Very well. I have described her eyes, I think."
"Very tediously."
"I will strive to be brief. Her lips are the most kissable that I have ever seen."
"And, as you remarked, you have experience," she murmured.
He bowed ironically. "Altogether, she's as spirited a filly as you could wish for. All she needs is bringing to heel."
"Does one bring a filly to heel? I rather thought—"
"As usual, my dear Lavinia, you are right. One does not. One breaks in a filly. I beg leave to thank you for correcting my mixed metaphor."
"Oh, pray, do not mention it."
"I will cease to do so. She needs breaking in. It should be amusing to tame her."
"Should it?"
She looked curiously at him. "Vastly. I am persuaded it can be done. I will have her."
"But what if she'll none of you?"
Suddenly the heavy lids were raised. "She will have no choice." Lady Lavinia shivered and sat up.
"La, Tracy! Will you have no sense of decency?" she cried. "I suppose," she sneered, "you think to kidnap the girl?"
"Exactly," he nodded. She gasped at the effrontery of it.
"Heavens, are you mad? Kidnap a lady? This is no peasant girl, remember. Tracy, Tracy, pray do not be foolish. How can you kidnap her?"
"That, my dear, is a point which I have not yet decided. But I do not anticipate much trouble."
"But goodness gracious me, has the child no protectors, no brothers, no father?"
"There is a father," said Tracy slowly. "He was here at the beginning of their stay. He does not signify. And, which is important, he is of those that truckle. Were I to make myself known to him, I believe I might marry the girl within an hour. But I do not want that, at least not yet."
"Good God, Tracy, do you think you are living in the dark ages? One cannot do these things now, I tell you." "Will you not at least remember that you represent our house? 'Twill be a pretty thing, and there is a scandal."
She broke off hopelessly and watched him flick a remnant of snuff from his cravat.
"Oh, Tracy, 'tis indeed a dangerous game you play. Pray consider."
"Really, Lavinia, you are most entertaining. I trust I am capable of caring for myself in mine own honour."
"Oh, don't sneer, don't sneer," she cried. "Sometimes I think I quite hate you."
"You would be the more amusing, my dear."
She swept the back of her hand across her eyes in a characteristic movement.
"How cross I am," she said, and laughed waveringly.
"You must bear with me, Tracy. Indeed, I am not well."
"You should take the waters," he repeated.
"Oh, I do, I do. And that reminds me that I must look for your beauty."
"She is not like to be there," he answered. "'Tis only very seldom that she appears."
"What? Is she then religious?"
"Religious? Why, in heaven's name?"
"But not to walk in the rooms?"
"She is staying here with her aunt, who has been ill. They do not mix much in society."
"How very dreadful! Yet she is to walk in the rooms, for you meant her there?"
"Yes," he admitted coolly. "'Tis for that reason that she now avoids them."
"Oh, Tracy, the poor child!" exclaimed his sister in a sudden fit of pity. "How can you persecute her if she dislikes you?"
"She does not."
"Not? Then—"
"Rather, she fears me. But she is intrigued, for all that. I persecute her, as you call it, for her own and my ultimate good. But they quit Bath in a few days, and then—" "Nous verrons." He rose. "What of honest Dick?"
"Don't call him by that odious name. I will not have it."
"Odious, my dear? Odious? You would have reason, and I called him dishonest Dick."
"Don't, don't,"
she cried, covering her ears. His Grace laughed softly.
"No, Lavinia, you must get the better of these megrims of yours, for there is naught that sickens a man sooner, believe me."
"Oh, go away, go away," she implored. "You tease me and tease me until I cannot bear it. And indeed I do not mean to be shrewish. Please go."
"I am on the point of doing so, my dear. I trust you will have in a measure recovered when next I see you. Pray, bear my respects to the Honourable Richard."
She stretched out her hand.
"Come again soon," she begged. "I shall be better tomorrow. 'Tis only today that my head aches, till I could shriek with the worry and the pain of it. Come again."
"Unfortunately, I anticipate leaving Bath within a day or two, but nothing would have given me greater pleasure than to comply with your wishes."
He kissed her hand punctiliously and took his leave. At the door he paused and looked back mockingly.
"By the way, her name is Diana."
He bowed again and swept out, as Lavinia buried her face in the cushions and burst into tears. It was thus that Richard found her 20 minutes later, and his concern was so great that it in part restored her spirits, and she spent a quiet and, for him, blissful evening playing at piquet. In the middle of a game she suddenly flung down her hand and caught at his wrist.
"Dicky, Dicky, I will go home."
"Go home? What do you mean?
Not—" "Yes, yes, Wyncham. Why not?"
"My dear, do you mean it?"
His voice quivered with joyful surprise, and the card slipped from his hands.
"Yes, I mean it. But take me quickly before I change my mind. I can sleep at Wyncham, and here I lie awake all night, and my head aches. Take me home, and I will try to be a better wife. Oh, Dicky, have I been tiresome and exacting? I did not mean to be. Why do you let me?"
She came quickly round the table and knelt at his side, giving no heed to the crumpling of her billowing silks.
"I have been a wicked, selfish woman," she said vehemently. "But indeed, I will be better. You must not let me be bad. You must not, I tell you."
He flung his arm about her plump shoulders and drew her tightly to him.
"When I get you home, at Wyncham, I promise you, "I will finally hector you, sweetheart," he said, laughing, to conceal his deeper feelings. "I shall make you into a capital housewife."
"And I will learn to make butter," she nodded. "Then I must wear a dimity gown with a muslin apron and cap. Oh, yes, yes, a dimity gown."
She sprang up and danced to the middle of the room.
"Shall I not be charming, Richard?"
"Very charming, Lavinia."
"Of course. Oh, we will go home at once, at once. But first I must procure some new gowns for Marguerite."
"To make butter in, my dear?" he protested. She was not attending.
"A dimity gown, or shall it be a tiffany with a quilted petticoat, or both?"
She chanted.
"Dicky, I shall set a fashion in country toilettes."
Dicky sighed. End of chapter 6. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona, July 2011.
Chapter 7 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 7. Introducing Sundry New Characters. Not 20 minutes' walk from Lady Lavinia's house in Queen Square resided a certain Madame Thompson, a widow, who had lived in Bath for nearly 15 years. With her was staying Miss Elizabeth Beauleigh and her niece Diana. Madame Thompson had been at a seminary with Miss Elizabeth when both were girls, and they had ever afterwards kept up their friendship, occasionally visiting one another, but more often contenting themselves with the writings of lengthy epistles, full of unimportant scraps of news and much gossip, amusing only on Miss Elizabeth's side, and on the widow's uninteresting and rambling. It was a great joy to Madame Thompson when she received a letter from Miss Beauleigh, begging that she and her niece might be allowed to pay a visit to her house in Bath, and to stay at least 3 weeks. The good lady was delighted at having her standing invitation at last accepted, and straightway wrote back a glad assent. She prepared her very best bedchamber for Miss Beauleigh, who, she understood, was coming to Bath principally for a change of air and scene after a long and rather trying illness. In due course the two ladies arrived, the elder very small and thin and bird-like in her movements, the younger moderately tall and graceful as a willow tree, with great candid brown eyes that looked fearlessly out onto the world, and a tragic mouth that belied a usually cheerful disposition, and hinted at a tendency to look on the gloomy side of life. Madame Thompson, whose first meeting with Diana this was, remarked on the sad mouth to Miss Elizabeth, or Betty as she was more often called, as they sat over the fire on the first night, Diana herself having retired to her room. Miss Betty shook her head darkly, and prophesied that her precious Di would one day love some man as no man, in her opinion, deserved to be loved.
"And she'll have love badly," she said, clicking her knitting needles energetically. "I know these temperamental children."
"She looks so melancholy," ventured the widow.
"Well, there you are wrong," replied Miss Betty. "'Tis the sunniest-tempered child, and the sweetest-natured in the whole wide world, bless her. But I don't deny that she can be miserable, far from it. Why, I've known her weep her pretty eyes out over a dead puppy, even. But usually she is gay enough."
"I fear this house will be dull and stupid for her," said Madame Thompson regretfully. "If only my dear son George were at home to entertain her."
"My love, pray do not put yourself out. I assure you Diana will not at all object to a little quiet after the life she has been leading in town this winter with her friend's family."
Whatever Diana thought of the quiet, she at least made no complaint, and adapted herself to her surroundings quite contentedly. In the morning they would all walk as far as the assembly rooms, and Miss Betty would drink the waters in the old pump-room, pacing sedately up and down with her friend on one side and her niece on the other. Madame Thompson had very few acquaintances in Bath, and the people she did know were all of her own age and habits, rarely venturing as far as the crowded fashionable quarter. So Diana had to be content with the society of the two old ladies, who gossiped happily enough together, but whose conversation she could not but find singularly uninteresting. She watched the monde with concealed wistfulness, seeing Beau Nash strut about among the ladies, bowing with his extreme gallantry, always impeccably garbed, and in spite of his rapidly increasing age and bulk, still absolute monarch of Bath. She saw fine-painted madams in enormous hoops, and with their hair so extravagantly curled and powdered that it appeared quite grotesque, mincing along with their various cavaliers, elderly beaux with coats padded to hide their shrunken shoulders, and paint to fill the wrinkles on their faces, young rakes, stout dowagers with their demure daughters, old ladies who had come to Bath for their health's sake, titled folk of fashion, and plain gentry from the country, all parading before her eyes. One or two young bucks tried to ogle her, and received such indignant glances from those clear eyes that they never dared annoy her again. But for the most part, no one paid any heed to the unknown and plainly clad girl. Then came His Grace of Andover upon the stage. He drew Diana's attention from the first moment that he entered the pump-room, a black moth amongst the gaily hued butterflies. He had swept a comprehensive glance round the scene, and at once perceived Diana. Somehow, exactly how she could never afterwards remember, he had introduced himself to her aunt, and won that lady's good will by his smoothness of manner and polished air. Madame Thompson, who left to herself, never visited the assembly rooms, could not be expected to recognize Devil Belmanoir in the simple Mr. Everard, who presented himself. As he had told his sister, Diana was cold. There was something about his grace that repelled her, even while his mesmeric personality fascinated. He was right when he said that she feared him. She was nervous, and the element of fear gave birth to curiosity. She was intrigued, and began to look forward to his daily appearance in the pump-room with mingled excitement and apprehension. She liked his flattering attention and his grand air. Often she would watch him stroll across the floor, bowing to right and left with that touch of insolence that characterized him, and rejoiced in the knowledge that he was coming straight to her, and that the painted beauties who so palpably ogled and invited him to their sides could not alter his course. She felt her power with a thrill of delight, and smiled upon Mr. Everard, giving him her hand to kiss, and graciously permitting him to sit with her beside her aunt. He would point out all the celebrities of town and Bath for her edification, recalling carefully chosen and still more carefully censored anecdotes of each one. She discovered that Mr. Everard was an entertaining and harmless enough companion, and even expanded a little, allowing him a glimpse of her whimsical nature with its laughter and its hints of tears. His Grace of Andover saw enough to guess at the unsounded depths of her soul, and he became lover-like. Diana recoiled instinctively, throwing up a barrier of reserve between them. It was not what he said that alarmed her, but it was the way in which he said it, and the vague something in the purring, faintly sinister voice that she could not quite define, that made her heart beat unpleasantly fast, and the blood rush to her temples. She began first to dread the morning promenade, and then to avoid it. One day she had a headache, the next her foot was sore, another time she wanted to work at her fancy stitchery, until her aunt, who knew how she disliked her needle, and how singularly free from headaches and all petty ailments she was wont to be, openly taxed her with no longer wishing to walk abroad. They were in the girl's bedroom at the time, Diana seated before her dressing-table, brushing out her hair for the night, when her aunt put the abrupt question. She hesitated, caught a long strand in her comb, and pretended to be absorbed in its disentanglement. The clouds of rippling hair half hid her face, but Miss Betty observed how her fingers trembled, and repeated her question. Then came the confession. Mr. Everard was unbearable, his attentions were odious, his continued presence revolting to Mistress Di. She was afraid of him, afraid of his dreadful green eyes, and his soft voice. She wished they had never come to Bath, and still more that they had not met him. He looked at her as if,
Oh, in short, he was hateful. Miss Betty was horrified. You cannot mean it, dear. Dear, dear, here was I thinking what a pleasant gentleman he was, and all the time he was persecuting my poor Di, the wretch. I know the type, my love, and I feel inclined to give him a good piece of my mind. Oh, no, no, implored Diana. Indeed, you must do no such thing, auntie. He has said naught that I could possibly be offended at. 'Tis but his manner, and the way he looked at me. Indeed, indeed, you must not. Tut, child, of course I shall say naught, but it makes me so monstrous angry to think of my poor lamb being tormented by such as he, that I declare I could tear his eyes out. Yes, my dear, I could. Thank goodness we are leaving Bath next week. Yes, sighed Diana. I cannot help being glad, though Madame Thompson is very amiable. 'Tis so very different when there is no man with one. You are quite right, my love. We should have insisted on your father staying with us instead of allowing him to fly back to his fusty, musty old volumes. I shall not be so foolish another time, I can assure you. But we need not go to the assembly rooms again.
I need not go, corrected Diana gently. Of course, you and Madame Thompson will continue to.
To tell you the truth, my love, confessed Miss Betty, I shall not be sorry for an excuse to stay away. 'Tis doubtless most ill-natured of me, but I cannot but think that Hester has altered sadly since last I saw her. She is always talking of sermons and good works.
Diana twisted her luxuriant hair into a long plait and gave a gurgling little laugh.
Oh, auntie, is it not depressing? I wondered how you could tolerate it. She is so vastly solemn, poor dear thing.
Well, said Miss Betty charitably, she has seen trouble, has Hester Thompson, and I have my doubts about this George of hers, a worthless young man, I fear, from all accounts. But unkind though it may be, I shall be glad to find myself at home again, and that's the truth.
She rose and picked up her candle.
In fact, I find Bath not half so amusing as I was told 'twould be.
Diana walked with her to the door.
'Tis not amusing at all when one has no friends, but last year, when my cousins were with us, and Papa took a house for the season on the North Parade, 'twas most enjoyable. I wish you had been there, instead of with that disagreeable Aunt Jennifer.
She kissed her relative most affectionately and lighted her across the landing to her room. Then she returned to her own, and shut the door, giving a tired little yawn. It was at about that moment that His Grace of Andover was ushered into the already crowded card-room of Milord Avon's house in Catherine Place, and was greeted with ribald cries of,
"Oho, Belmanoir! Where's the lady, devil?"
He walked coolly forward into the full light of a great pendant chandelier, standing directly beneath it, the diamond order on his breast burning and winking like a living thing. The diamonds in his cravat and on his fingers glittered every time he moved, until he seemed to be carelessly powdered with iridescent gems. As usual, he was clad in black, but it would have been difficult to find any other dress in the room more sumptuous or more magnificent than his sable satin, with its heavy silver lacing and shimmering waistcoat. Silver lace adorned his throat and fell in deep ruffles over his hands, and in defiance of fashion, which decreed that black alone should be worn to tie the hair, he displayed long silver ribands, very striking against his unpowdered head. He raised his quizzing-glass and looked round the room with an air of surprised hauteur. Lord Avon, leaning back in his chair at one of the tables, shook a reproving finger at him.
"Belmanoir, Belmanoir, we have seen her, and we protest she is too charming for you."
"In truth, we think we should be allowed a share in the ladieth smileth," lisped one from behind him, and His Grace turned to face dainty, effeminate little Viscount Fotheringham, who stood at his elbow, resplendent in salmon-pink satin and primrose velvet, with skirts so full and stiffly whale-boned that they stood out from his person and heels so high that instead of walking he could only mince. Tracy made a low leg.
"Surely, shall you have a share in her smiles, and she wills it so?"
he purred, and a general laugh went up, which caused the fop to flush to the ears as he speedily effaced himself. He had been one of those who had tried to accost Diana, and gossip-loving Will Stapley with him at the time had related the story of his discomfiture to at least half a dozen men, who immediately told it to others, vastly amused at the pertinacious Viscount's rebuff.
"What was it Selwyn said?" drawled Sir Gregory Markham, shuffling cards at Lord Avon's table. Davenant looked across at him inquiringly. "George? Of Belmanoir? When?" "Oh, at White's one night, I forget. Jack Cholmondeley was there. He would know, and Horry Walpole. 'Twas of devil in his light of loves, quite apt on the whole." Cholmondeley looked up. "Did I hear my name?" "Aye. What was it that George said of Belmanoir at White's the night Gilly made that absurd bet with Folliot?" "When Gilly—oh, yes, I remember. 'Twas but an old hexameter tag, playing on his name. Es belem belli, belim belle puelle. He seemed to think it a fitting motto for a ducal house." There was another general laugh at this. Markham broke in on it.
"Who is she, Tracy?" His Grace turned. "Who is who?" he asked languidly. Lord Avon burst out laughing. "Oh, come now, Belmanoir, that won't do, it really will not. Who is she indeed?" "Ay, Belmanoir, who is the black-haired beauty, and where did you find her?" cried Tom Wilding, pressing forward with a glass in one hand and a bottle of port in the other. "I thought you were captivated by Cynthia Evans." Tracy looked bewildered for the moment, and then a light dawned on him. "Evans, ah, yes, the saucy widow who lived in Kensington, was it not? I remember." "He had forgotten," cried Avon, and went off into another of the noisy laughs that had more than once caused Mr. Nash to shudder and to close his august eyes. "You'll be the death of me, devil, gad, but you will." "Oh, I trust not. Thank you, Wilding." He accepted the glass that Tom offered and sipped delicately.
"But you've not answered," reminded Fortescue from another table. He dealt the cards round expertly. "It is hands-off, perhaps?"
"Certainly," replied his Grace. "It generally is, Frank, as you know."
"To my cost," was the laughing rejoinder, and Fortescue rubbed his sword-arm as if in memory of some hurt. "You pinked me finely, Tracy."
"Clumsily, Frank, clumsily. It might have been quicker done."
The Viscount, who had been a second at the meeting, tittered amiably.
"Neatest thing I ever saw, 'pon my honour. All over in less than a minute, Avon. Give you my word."
"Never knew you had fought, devil, Frank. What possessed you?"
"I was more mad than usual, I suppose," replied Fortescue in his low, rather dreamy voice. "And I interfered between Tracy and his French singer. He objected most politely, and we fought it out in Hyde Park."
"Gad, yes," exclaimed his partner, Lord Falmouth. "Why, I was devil's second. But it was ages ago."
2 years, nodded Fortescue. "But I have not forgotten, you see."
"Lord, I had. And 'twas the funniest fight I ever saw, with you as furious as could be and devil cool as a cucumber. You were never much of a swordsman, Frank, but that morning you thrust so wildly that stat me if I didn't think devil would run you through. Stead of that, he pinks you neatly through the sword-arm, and damn if you didn't burst out laughing fit to split. And then we all walked off to breakfast with you, Frank, as jolly as sandboys. Heavens, yes, that was a fight."
"It was amusing," admitted Tracy at Fortescue's elbow. "Don't play, Frank."
Fortescue flung his cards face downwards on the table.
"Curse you, Tracy, you've brought bad luck,"
he said entirely without rancour.
"I had quite tolerable hands before you came."
"Belmanoir, I will stake my chestnut mare against your new grey,"
lisped the Viscount, coming up to the table, dice-box in hand.
"Stop me, but that is too bad," cried Wilding. "Don't take him, devil. Have you seen the brute?"
The four players had finished their card-playing and were quite ready for the dice.
"Trust in your luck, Belmanoir, and take him," advised Pritchard, who loved hazarding other men's possessions, but kept a tight hold on his own. "Aye, take him," echoed Falmouth.
"Don't," said Fortescue.
"Of course I shall take him," answered his Grace tranquilly.
"My grey against your chestnut in the best of three. Will you throw?"
The
The Viscount rattled his box with a flourish. Two threes and one turned up. With a hand on Fortescue's shoulder and one foot on the rung of his chair, Tracy leaned forward and cast his own dice onto the table. He had beaten the Viscount's throw by five. The next toss, Fotheringham won, but the last fell to his grace.
"Damnathan," said the Viscount cheerfully, "will you take your grey against my terror?"
"Thunder and turf, Fotheringham, you'll lose him," cried Nettleford warningly. "Don't stake the terror."
"Nonsense. Do you take me, Belmanoir?"
"Certainly," said the Duke, and threw.
"Oh, and you are in a gaming mood. I will play for the right to try my hand with the dark beauty,"
called Markham across the room. "Against what?" asked Fortescue.
"Oh, what he wills."
The Viscount had cast and lost, and his grace won the second throw. "It appears my luck is in," he remarked. "I will stake my beauty against your estates, Markham." Sir Gregory shook his head, laughing.
"No, no, keep the lady."
"I intend to, my dear fellow. She is not your style. I begin to wonder whether she altogether suits my palate." He drew out his snuff-box and offered it to his host, and the other men, finding that he was proof against their railing, allowed the subject to drop. In the course of the evening, his grace won 3,000 guineas, 2 at ombre and 1 at dice, lost his coveted grey hunter, and won him back again from Wilding, to whom he had fallen. He came away at 3 o'clock in the company with Fortescue, both perfectly cool-headed, although his grace, for his part, had imbibed a considerable quantity of Burgundy, and more punch than any ordinary man can take without afterwards feeling very much the worse for wear. As my Lord Avon's door closed behind them, Tracy turned to his friend. "Shall we walk, Frank?" "Since our ways lie together, yes," replied Fortescue, linking his arm in the Duke's. "Down Brock Street and cross the circus is our quickest way." They strolled down the road for a few moments in silence, passing a linkman on the way. Fortescue bade him a cheery good night, which was answered in a very beery voice, but the Duke said nothing. Frank looked into his dark-browed face thoughtfully. "You've had the luck tonight, Tracy."
"Moderately. I hoped entirely to repair last week's losses."
"You are in debt, I suppose?"
"I believe so."
"To what extent, Tracy?"
"My dear fellow, I neither have nor wish to have the vaguest notion. Pray do not treat me to a sermon."
"I shall not.
I said all I have to say on the subject."
"Many times."
"Yes, many times. And it has had no more effect upon you than if I had not spoken."
"Less."
"I dare say. I wish it were not so, for there's good in you somewhere, Tracy."
"By what strange process of reasoning do you arrive at that?"
"Well," said Fortescue, laughing,
"there's nearly always some good in very worst of men.
I count on that and your kindness to me."
"I should be interested to know when I have been kind to you, beyond the time when I was compelled to teach you to leave me and my affairs alone."
"I was not referring to that occasion," was the dry answer. "I had not seen your act in that light. I meant well over the episode."
"You could not damn yourself more effectually than by saying that," said his grace calmly. "But we wander from the point. When have I done you an act of kindness?"
"You know very well. When you extricated me from that cursed sponging-house."
"I remember now. Yes, that was good of me. I wonder why I did it."
"'Tis what I want to know."
"I suppose I must have had some sort of an affection for you. I would certainly never have done such a thing for any one else."
"Not even for your own brother," said Frank sharply. They had crossed the circus and were walking down Gay Street now.
"Least of all for them," came the placid response. "You are thinking of Andrew's tragic act. Most entertaining, was it not?"
"You evidently found it so."
"I did. I wanted to prolong the sensation. But my esteemed brother-in-law came to the young fool's rescue."
"Would you have assisted him?"
"In the end, I fear I should have had to."
"I believe there must be a kink in your brain," cried Fortescue. "I cannot else account for your extraordinary conduct."
"We Belmanoirs are all half mad," replied Tracy sweetly. "But I think that in my case it is merely concentrated evil."
"I will not believe it. You have shown that you can behave differently. You do not try to strip me of all I possess. Why, all those unfortunate youths you play with? You see, you possess so little." The Duke excused himself. "Neither do you sneer at me in your loathsome fashion. Why?"
"Because I have hardly ever any desire to. I like you."
"Terre nuns! You must like someone else in the world besides me."
"I can think of no one, and I do not exactly worship the ground you tread on. The contemplation of my brothers appals me. I've loved various women, and shall no doubt love many more."
"No, Tracy," interposed Fortescue, "you have never loved a woman in your life. 'Tis that that might save you. I do not allude to the lustful passion you indulge in, but real love. For God's sake, Belmanoir, live clean."
"Pray do not distress yourself, Frank. I am not worth it."
"I choose to think that you are. I cannot but feel that if you had been loved as a boy, your mother—"
"Did you ever see my mother?" inquired His Grace lazily.
"No, but—"
"Have you ever seen my sister?"
Yes."
"In a rage?"
"Really, I—"
"Because if you have, you have seen my mother. Only she was 10 times more violent. In fact, we were a pleasant party when we were all at home."
"I understand."
"Good God! I believe you are sorry for me," cried Tracy scornfully.
"I am.
Is it a presumption on my part?"
"My dear Frank, when I am sorry for myself, you may be sorry too. Until then,
when that day comes, I shall no longer pity you."
"Very deep, Frank. You think I shall be on the road to recovery? A pretty conceit. Luckily, the happy moment has not yet come, and I do not think it is like to."
"We appear to have arrived." They were standing outside one of the tall houses where Fortescue lodged. He turned and grasped his friend's shoulders.
"Tracy, give up this mad life you lead. Give up the women and the drink and the excessive gaming for one day. Believe me, you will overstep yourself and be ruined."
The Duke disengaged himself.
"I very much object to being manhandled in the street," he complained. "I suppose you still mean well. You should strive to conquer the tendency."
"I wonder if you know how insolent is your tone, Belmanoir?" asked Fortescue steadily.
"Naturally. I should not have attained such perfection in the art of elves. But pray accept my thanks for your good advice. You will forgive me, and I do not avail myself of it, I am sure. I prefer the crooked path."
"Evidently," sighed the other. "If you will not try the straight and narrow way, I can only hope that you will fall very deeply and very honestly in love, and that the lady will save you from yourself."
"I will inform you of it when it comes to pass," promised His Grace. "And now, good night."
"Good night." Frank returned the low bow with a curt nod. "I shall see you tomorrow, that is this morning, at the baths."
"Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof," was the smiling rejoinder. "Sleep soundly, Frank."
He waved an ironic farewell and crossed the road to his own lodgings, which stood almost directly opposite.
"And I suppose you will sleep as soundly as if you had not a stain on your conscience and had not tried your uttermost to alienate the regard of the only friend you possess," remarked Frank bitterly to the darkness. "Damn you, Tracy, for the villain you are!"
He walked up the steps to his own front door and turned the key in the lock. He looked over his shoulder as a door slammed across the street.
"Poor devil," he said. "Oh, you poor devil."
End of Chapter 7. Recording by Tara Mendoza. Phoenix, Arizona, August 2011. Chapter 8 of The Black Moth. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tara Mendoza. The Black Moth by Georgette Hare. Chapter 8. The Biter Bit. With John Carstairs, the winter had passed quite uneventfully. He continued his highway robbery, but he made 2 bad blunders, not from the point of view of a thief, but from that of the gentleman in him. The first was, when he stopped an opulent-looking chariot which he found to contain two ladies, their maid and their jewels, and the second when the occupant of a large travelling-coach chanced to be an old gentleman who possessed far greater courage than physical strength. On the first occasion my lord's dismay had been ludicrous, and he had hastily retired after tendering a naive apology. The old gentleman in the second episode had defied him so gallantly that he had impulsively offered him the butt-end of one of his pistols. The old man was so surprised that he allowed the weapon to fall to the ground, where it exploded quite harmlessly, sending up a cloud of dust and smoke. Carstairs then begged his pardon most humbly, assisted him back into his coach, and rode off before the astonished Mr. Dunbar had time to collect his wits. The robbing was not carried out in a very scientific manner, for as has been seen, Carstairs could not bring himself to terrorize women or old men, and there only remained the young and the middle-aged gentleman, one of whom Jack offered to fight for the possession of his jewels. His challenge was promptly accepted by the man, who happened to possess a strong sense of humor, and probably saw a chance of saving his belongings in the offer. He had been speedily worsted, but Carstairs was so pleased with a particularly neat thrust which he had executed that he forewent half the booty, and the pair of them divided the contents of the jewel-box by the roadside, the sporting gentleman keeping his most valued belongings and giving Jack the surplus. They parted on the very best of terms, and all Carstairs got out of the episode was a little sword practice and a few trinkets. When day came he was patrolling the west side of Sussex, beyond Midhurst, not because he thought it a profitable part, but because he knew and loved the country. One late afternoon towards the end of the month he rode gaily into one of the small villages that nestle amongst the downs, and made his way down the quaint main street to the George Inn, where he drew rein and dismounted. At his call an aged ostler hobbled out of the side door, chewing an inevitable straw, and after eyeing the newcomer and his steed for an appreciable length of time, evidently decided that they were worthy of his attention, for he came forward, remarking that it had been a pleasant day. Carstairs agreed with him and volunteered the information that it would be another fine day tomorrow, if the sunset were to be trusted. To this the ostler replied that he, for one, never trusted to no red sunsets, and added darkly that there weren't nothing so deceitful to his manner of thinking. He'd known it to be such a red sunset as never was, and yet be a pouring with a rain all next day. Should he take the mare? Carstairs shook his head. No, I thank you. I remain here but for a few moments. I doubt she's thirsty, though. Eh, Jenny? Water, sir. For her, yes. For myself, I fancy a tankard of your home-brewed ale. Stand, Jenny. He turned away and walked up the steps to the inn door. Be ye going to leave her there, sir, a standing all by herself? Inquired the man, surprised. Why, yes. She's docile enough. Well, seems to me a risky thing to leave a hoss, and a skittish hoss at that, a standing loose in the road. You won't be tying her to a postmaster. Carstairs leaned his arms on the balustrade and looked down at them. I will not. She'd be very hurt at such treatment, wouldn't you, lass? Jenny tossed her head playfully as if in agreement, and the ostler scratched his head, looking from her to my lord. "'A'most seems as if she understands what you be saying to her, sir. Of course she understands. Don't I tell you 'tis a clever little lady? If I call her now, she'll come up these steps to me, and naught all the ostlers in Christendom could stop her. Don't you go for doing it, sir, urged the old man, backing. She must be uncommon fond of ye. She'd be a deal fonder if you'd fetch her a drink, hinted Jack broadly. Aye, sir, I'd be a-going this wary instant. And with many an anxious glance over his shoulder at the perfectly quiet mare, he disappeared through an open doorway into the yard. When Carstairs, tankard of ale in hand, emerged from the inn and sat himself down on one of the benches that stood against the wall, the mare was drinking thirstily from a bucket which the ancient one held for her. "'Tis a wonderful fine mare, sir,' he remarked at length, after a careful inspection of her points. Carstairs nodded pleasantly and surveyed Jenny through half-shut eyes. "'I think so every time I look at her,' he said. "'I should think she could get a bit of pace on her, sir. Maybe you've tried her racing?' "'No, she wasn't brought up to that.
but she's fast enough. Aye, sir, no vices? Lord, no. Don't kick neither. Not with me. Ah, they allus know who'll stand it and who won't. Jack drained his tankard, and setting it down on the bench beside him, rose to his feet. She'd not dream of kicking a friend. Jenny. The ostler watched her pick her way towards her master, coquetting with her head and sidling round him in the most playful manner possible. A slow smile dawned on the man's face. Ah, it'd be a birdie sight to watch her, so it be, he said, and received a guinea from Jack, who never tired of listening to praise of his beloved Jenny. Carstairs remounted, nodded farewell to the ostler, and rode leisurely on down the street, soon branching off to the right into a typical Sussex lane, where he trotted between uneven hedges, sweet with blossom and with may, and placid fields rolling away on either side, upwards until they merged into the undulating hills, barely discernible in the gloom. That of the downs, it was a wonderfully calm evening, with only a gentle west wind blowing, and the moon already shining faintly in the dark sky. There was nothing beyond the sound of the mare's hoofs to break the beautiful stillness of it all. He rode for some way, without meeting a soul, and when at the end of an hour someone did chance along the road, it was only a laborer returning home to his supper after a long day in the fields. John bade him a cheery good evening, and watched him pass on down the road humming. After that he met no one. He rode easily along for miles, into the fast-gathering darkness. He was frowning as he rode, thinking. Curiously enough, it was on his penniless days in France that his mind dwelt this evening. He had resolutely thrust that dark time behind him, determined to forget it. But there were still days when, try as he might, he could not prevent his thoughts flying back to it. With clenched teeth he recalled the days when he, the son of an earl, had taught fencing in Paris for a living. Suddenly he laughed harshly, and at the unusual sound the mare pricked up her ears and sidled uneasily across the road. For once no notice was taken of her, and she quickened her pace with a flighty toss of her head. He thought how he, the extravagant John, had pinched and scraped and saved rather than go under, how he had lived in one of the poorer quartiers of the city, alone without friends, nameless. Then, cynically now, he reviewed the time when he had taken to drinking, heavily and systematically, and had succeeded in pulling himself up at the very brink of the pit he saw yawning before him. Next, the news of his mother's death. John passed over that quickly. Even now the thought of it had the power of rousing in him all the old misery and impotent resentment. His mind sped on to his Italian days. On his savings he had travelled to Florence, and from there he went gradually south, picking up all the latest arts and subtleties of fence on the way. The change of scene and of people did much to restore his spirits. His devil-may-care ways peeped out again. He started to gamble on the little money he had left. For once fortune proved kind. He doubled and trebled and quadrupled the contents of his purse. Then it was that he met Jim Salter, whom he engaged as his servant. This was the first friend since he had left England. Together they travelled about Europe, John gambling his way, Jim keeping a relentless hand on the exchequer. It was entirely owing to his watchfulness and care that John was not ruined, for his luck did not always hold good, and there were days when he lost with distressing steadiness. But Jim guarded the winnings jealously, and there was always something to fall back on. At last, the longing for England and English people grew so acute that John made up his mind to return. But he found that things in England were very different from what they had been abroad. Here he was made to feel acutely that he was outcast. It was impossible to live in town under an assumed name, as he would like to have done, for far too many people knew Jack Carstairs and would remember him. He saw that he must either live secluded, or the idea of becoming a highwayman occurred to him. A hermit's existence he knew to be totally unsuited to a man of his temperament. But the free, adventurous spirit of the road appealed to him. The findings of his mare, Jay, the third as he laughingly dubbed her, decided the point. He forthwith took on himself the role of quixotic highwayman. Roaming his beloved South Country, happier than he had been since he first left England, bit by bit regaining his youth and spirits, which last, not all the trouble he had been through, had succeeded in extinguishing. Clip-clap,
Clip-clop. With a jerk he came back to earth and reined in his mare, the better to listen. Along the road came the unmistakable sound of horses' hoofs and the scrunch-scrunch of swiftly revolving wheels on the sandy surface. By now the moon was right out, but owing to the fact that she was playing at hide-and-seek in and out of the clouds, it was fairly dark. Nevertheless, Jack fastened his mask over his face with quick, deft fingers, and pulled his hat well over his eyes. His ears told him that the vehicle, whatever it was coming towards him. So he drew into the side of the road, and taking a pistol from its holster, sat waiting, his eyes on the bend in the road. Nearer and nearer came the horses, until the leader swung round the corner. Carstairs saw that it was an ordinary travelling chariot and levelled his pistol.
"Halt, or I fire!"
He had to repeat the command before it was heard, and to ride out from the shadow of the hedge. The chariot drew up, and the coachman leaned over the side to see who it was bidding them to stop in so peremptory a manner.
"What do you want? What are ye? Is there aught amiss?"
he cried testily, and found himself staring at a long-nosed pistol.
"Throw down your arms." "I ain't got none, blast ye."
"On your honour," Jack dismounted.
"Aye, wish I had, and I'd see ye damned afore I'd throw 'em down."
At this moment the door of the coach opened, and a gentleman leapt lightly down onto the road. He was big and loose-limbed as far as Carstairs could see, and carried himself with an easy grace. My lord presented his pistol.
"Stand,"
he ordered gruffly. The moon peeped coyly out from behind a cloud, and shed her light upon the little group as if to see what all the fuss was about. The big man's face was in the shadow, but Jack's pistol was not. Into its muzzle the gentleman gazed, one hand deep in the pocket of his heavy cloak, the other holding a small pistol.
"Me very dear friend," he said in a rich brogue, "perhaps ye are not aware that that same pistol ye are pointing at me is unloaded. Don't move, I have ye covered."
Jack's arm fell to his side, and the pistol he held clattered to the ground, but it was not surprise at Jim's defection that caused him that violent start. It was something far more overwhelming, for the voice that proceeded from the tall gentleman belonged to one whom 6 years ago he had counted, next to Richard, his greatest friend on earth. The man moved a little, and the moonlight shone full on his face, clearly outlining the large nose and good-humoured mouth, and above the sleepy eyes, Miles! Miles O'Hara! For once Jack could find nothing amusing in the situation. It was too inconceivably hideous that he should meet his friend in this guise, and further be unable to reveal himself. A great longing to tear off his mask and to grasp Miles' hand assailed him. With an effort he choked it down and listened to what O'Hara was saying.
"If you would be so kind as to give me your word of honour you'll not be after trying to escape, I should be greatly obliged. But I tell ye that if ye attempt to move, I shall shoot."
Jack made a hopeless gesture with his hand. He felt dazed. The whole thing was ridiculous. How Miles would laugh afterwards. He went cold. There would be no afterwards. Miles would never know. He would be given over to the authorities, and Miles would never know that he had helped Jack Carstairs to the scaffold. Perhaps, too, he would not mind so very much, now that he, Jack, was so disgraced. One could never tell, even if he risked everything now and told his true identity. Miles might turn away from him in disgust. Miles, who could never stoop to a dishonourable act. Carstairs felt that he would bear anything sooner than face this man's scorn.
"Never tell me 'tis a dumb man ye are, for I heard ye shout meself. Do ye give me your word of honour, or must I have ye bound?"
Carstairs pulled himself together and set his teeth as he faced the inevitable. Escape was impossible. Miles would shoot, he felt sure, and then his disguise would be torn away, and his friend would see that Jack Carstairs was nothing but a common highwayman. Whatever happened, that must not be, for the sake of the name and Richard, so he quietly held out his hands.
I give my word, but ye can bind me if ye choose."
It was his highwayman's voice, raucous and totally unlike his own. But O'Hara's eyes were fixed on the slender white hands held out to him. In his usual haphazard fashion, Jack had quite forgotten to grime his hands. They were shapely and white, and carefully manicured. Miles took either wrist in his large hand, and turned them palm upwards in the moonlight. "Singularly white hands ye have, for one in your profession."
he drawled, and tightened his hold as Jack tried to draw them away. "No, you do not. Now be so good as to step within, me friend." Jack held back an instant. "My mare?" he asked, and O'Hara noted the anxiety in his voice. "Ye need not be after worrying about her," he said. "George!" The footman sprang forward. "Yes, sir. I want you to ride her home. Can you do it?" "Yes, sir."
"I doubt it," murmured Jack.
So did Jenny. She refused point-blank to allow this stranger to mount her. Her master had left her in one spot, and there she would stand until he chose to bid her move. In vain did the groom coax and coerce. She ran round him and seemed a transformed creature. She laid her ears flat and gnashed at the bit, ready to lash out furiously at the first opportunity. Jack watched the man's futile struggles with the ghost of a smile about his lips. "Jenny," he said quietly, and O'Hara looked round at him sharply, frowning. Unconsciously, he had spoken naturally, and the voice was faintly familiar. Jenny twitched the bridle from the perspiring groom and minced up to the prisoner.
"Would ye allow me to have a hand free, sir?" he asked. "Maybe I can manage her."
Without a word, Miles released him, and he caught the bridle, murmuring something unintelligible to the now quiet animal. O'Hara watched the beautiful hand stroke her muzzle reassuringly and frowned again. No ordinary highwayman, this.
"Mount her now, will ye?"
Jack flung at the groom, and kept a warning hand on the rein as the man obeyed. With a final pat, he turned away.
"She'll do now, sir."
O'Hara nodded.
"You've trained her well. Get in, please."
Jack obeyed, and in a minute or two, O'Hara jumped in after him, and the coach began to move forward. For a while there was silence, Carstairs keeping himself well under control. It was almost unbearable to think that after this brief drive he would never set eyes on his friend again, and he wanted so badly to turn and grasp that strong hand. Miles turned in his seat, and tried to see that masked face in the darkness. "You're a gentleman?" he asked, going straight to the point. Jack was prepared for this.
"Me, sir? Lord, no, sir."
"I do not believe ye. Don't be forgetting I've seen your hands."
"Hands, sir?"
in innocent bewilderment.
"Sure. You don't think I'd be believing ye're an ordinary rogue with hands like that?" "I don't rightly understand ye, sir."
"Be jabers, then. You'll be understanding me tomorrow."
"Tomorrow, sir?"
"Certainly. You may as well tell me now as then. I'm not such a daft fool as I look, and I know a gentleman when I see one, even if he does growl at me as you do," he chuckled. "And I had an only feeling I knew ye when ye spoke to the mayor. I'd be loath to send a friend to the gallows." How well Jack knew that soft, persuasive voice. His hands clenched as he forced himself to answer.
"I don't think I've ever seen ye before, sir."
"Maybe ye have not. We shall see tomorrow."
"What do you mean by tomorrow, sir?"
ventured Carstairs uneasily.
"Sure. You will have the honour of appearing before me, my friend." "Before you, sir?"
"Why not? I'm a justice of the peace.
Heaven save the mark."
There was a breathless pause, and then at last the funny side of it struck Jack, and his shoulders shook with suppressed laughter. The exquisite irony of it was almost too much for him. He, the Earl of Wyncham, was to be formally questioned by his friend St. Michael's O'Hara, J.P. "What ails ye now, man? You find it amusing?" asked Miles, surprised.
"Oh, Lord, yes,"
gasped Jack, and collapsed into his corner. End of Chapter 8. Recording by Tara Mendoza, Phoenix, Arizona, August 2011.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the long-lasting power you need with Energizer. Menards has the largest in-stock selection of Energizer batteries. They provide solid power for flashlights, remotes, and so much more. Right now, save big on Energizer batteries. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.